Okay.
Scott Kelly, welcome back. We are still live.
Okay. Well, are you ready to continue with the Secretary's agenda? Any additional questions on the Secretary's agenda? Madam Treasurer?
I don't think so.
I have a question on items 1 through 6. It's a generic issue. A 1 through 6.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Items A 1 through 6 are emergency reports from the Department of General Services. On behalf of the Department of Health, we do have Secretary Schrader available.
Yes, I'm pleased that hopefully he's available, and I think it would be remiss if I didn't comment, at least ask about the, since I have Secretary Schrader here, the lab genomics test kits that were procured from South Korea, given the Washington Post story published 2 weeks ago. I was grateful and have consistently applauded the Hogan administration for their leadership and management of the pandemic, especially given the fact that the Trump administration abdicated their responsibilities at the national level and forced states like Maryland to fend for themselves and procure their own test kits, ventilators, PPE, and other supplies. However, I was surprised at the revelations in the Washington Post article, which was a long article, information that was never presented to this board or shared with our staff and the Department of Health has brought items related to lab genomics in the past. As Comptroller of the State, a member of the Board of Public Works, there are a lot of unanswered questions that I believe need to be clarified, especially since even health department officials couldn't account for some irregularities as reported by the Washington Post. So, Secretary Schrader, thank you for agreeing to at least try to answer a couple of these questions. First, with respect to Cyan Diagnostics in the article, you indicated you did not know in the article why the state was paying Cyan $98 per test when we provided them with the test kit. Now that 2 weeks have passed since that article's publication, have you been able to get some clarity on why they were charging us such a large amount of money, given that we were providing them with the actual test?
Mr. Comptroller, can you hear me?
I can, yes.
That's great. Thank you, Governor and Treasurer Comptroller Rancho. What we had told the reporter, and they did not print, is that we originally had six contracts that we brought forward, and there, $98 was the test. We renegotiated the rate when in August and early September when we started giving Cyan the test, and they've been, that rate was $93. So we took a $5 discount off the price of the test when we started giving them the test to run. So we had told that to the reporter, but they did not publish that.
And what is the payment we make to other labs similar to Cyan
Diagnostics? They range in the $90 to $100 range, sir, across the board. So like LabCorp was $100, $69 for Quest, $100 for Mako. University of Maryland lab was $90, Cyan 93, and ICMD was $100. So the preponderance of them were between $90 and $100, with half of them at $100.
And they were using their own test kits, I take it, or not?
Correct. That's correct.
Okay.
One clarification, sir, because did UMPA, the University of Maryland, for a period, used 125,000 of our tests. But they were also giving deep discounts to nursing homes and state agencies, which were down around $40 a test. So we had a significant discount on those tests.
Okay. And when did you, at the Department of Health or your colleagues, when were you made aware of irregularities and defects associated with the lab genomics test kits? I'm thinking that maybe it's the University of Maryland ones, because I remember someone that was affiliated with the industry complaining that 37 of their employees had been diagnosed as COVID positive by these early tests, and obviously caused tremendous consternation. All 37 were retested, and all the tests were incorrect. So I take it early on there was some indication that there was a problem with some of the test kits, I take it, or not.
So if I may clarify, Mr. Comptroller, because I know this gets a little complicated, the false positives were part of the second upgraded batch, not the initial batch. There were no tests done on the first batch for patients that were tested. So the false positives that we became aware of were on the second batch, and our Office of Healthcare Quality went in and did a compliance review for the UM lab and found that the kits were not part of the problem from what they could tell, and that's a public document. So they're two different things. The original kits, there were no tests done with those.
What was the number of those kits that were not used?
About 496,500. I think in the process of trying to validate the tests with various labs, we used about 3,500 of them.
Those are the ones that you put aside, even though we've gotten them. And then I take it they were
the ones from South Korea?
Yes. Yes.
Yes, and ma'am, if I might, the both batches were from South Korea. It was just two different batches. And the first batch was set back the manufacturer actually picked them up and took them away, and that was after they sent us the upgraded tests, and those are the ones we've been using. We're up to 430,000. Of the 500,000 have now been used to test.
But you sent back the first batch minus 3,500, I guess, that were used.
Rough and ready, yes, sir. Yeah.
I guess the second question, unless the treasurer wants to, but feel free to jump in. Why did we add $2.5 million to the swap of 500,000 tests that we were concerned about with 500,000 new tests?
Yeah, so let me first say that I don't have intimate knowledge of this because I wasn't involved in the process. I've been reconstructing the fact pattern for a variety of questions that we've been getting from different sources. But what I understand is that, and you have to remember that at that point in time in March, April, May, we were in chaos because we didn't have enough tests. We started with 50 and we built to 50,000. So when we were negotiating with the contractor, the folks involved, their objective was to get those tests here. And, you know, one could criticize it and say, well, maybe we shouldn't have spent that money. But at that time, and I was involved in the surge part of it, where we were buying ventilators and the market, the things just weren't available. We were paying a lot of money. The market has changed again because the availability is different today. But at that time, we were in crisis.
Okay. So I'm not suggesting that there was anything that I'm particularly focused on. I'm just trying to get an idea because this was back in sometime in April, May, when you were learning that there were problems with the test, and then you swapped it out and came to us in September 2nd board meeting with a $9 million emergency contract. And I guess the question is, shouldn't some of that knowledge about defective tests initially, at least we should have been informed about it?
So, well, here's the fact pattern, sir, and then maybe we can have a conversation about it, is that I became involved personally in driving testing around mid-June. And my understanding is that at some point in early June, there had been a request to put this emergency first batch on the board agenda. From what I understand, the board was not ready to take it up at that time, and they said, come back when you have a lot more information. I got involved, and by then the other tests were being sent back, and we had the new tests. And by the end of June, we had done about 29,000. By the end of August, about 100,000. By the time we got to the board in September, we were talking about the second batch, and the other batch was gone. So the focus was really on the second batch and explaining it. And because we had not paid anything for the other batch and it had already been given back, it never really came to the board for a vote. So it had been delayed initially, but then when they went back, it never came back to the board because we were focused on the second batch in September.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just want to also, you know, clarify and, you know, something that Dennis just said. And you remember, it was first brought back, I think Dennis said, in June, but it was all in a spreadsheet of all these different items and the board and I believe, you know, the treasurer and yourself wanted to see them separated out. And so it took some time to go back and separate out. There was some questions about, I guess, the invoicing process and the accounting process that took some time to go back through. And that's why it then was delayed and brought in September, the initial batch, and then as an emergency procurement, and then I think maybe a week or two later, there was the other batch was brought in, maybe 2 weeks later.
I'm not suggesting Secretary Schrader did anything wrong here personally, because I know he's arriving midstream. I'm just wondering, why did we pay $2.5 million more than we originally agreed to? Is that simply market rate or something, Secretary Schrader?
My understanding from the discussions I've had trying to get the answer to that question, it's a very legitimate question, is that we were under pressure and we were negotiating with the manufacturer, and the manufacturer was not willing to just replace the test. They felt they were entitled to some remuneration, and that was, and at the time, because of the crisis we were in and we wanted the test, and it's turned out to be a good thing we had them, there was a sense at that time by those involved that the $2.5 million would be valuable to get the tests here. I can't speak with firsthand knowledge. Everything I'm telling you is secondhand.
I'm putting you off in a different category just because of the fact that you joined midstream on some of these issues, but in early September, apparently, there were 76 staff and patients at a nursing home in Howard County who tested positive for the virus. It was quickly learned, apparently, that these were false positives and that they had all been tested using the lab genomics test. So I assume that those 76 false positive cases were also replicated in other tests that we conducted with the lab genomics kits. So have you been able to track false positives and tally what the actual total is?
Let me make sure I answer this question clearly. When this happened, number one, we get some false positives from time to time, but a lot of times they'll rerun the tests. But in this particular case, when we heard about this, we talked to the lab, and there were actually, from what I understand, two or three nursing homes that had false positives. But then when we went back and looked at the labs, there was no indication that there was a problem with the test. We had the Office of Healthcare Quality go in and do a compliance review, and their report says that there was nothing that they could say that indicated there was a problem with the test kits themselves. They were focused more on the procedures of the lab. There are a lot of different reasons why a test could be false positive. It would be how the sample is collected, could the nursing home, who, how their methodology for getting the sample, it could have been how they were handled at the lab. So there were a number of recommendations to the UMB lab in their processing that were within the report that they've implemented. So there was no indication that the kits themselves caused the false positives.
Okay. Is that the reason then the company also felt justified in adding $2.5 million for replacing what we thought were faulty tests, and they claim they weren't, or do they claim they were okay tests? It's just that we didn't implement them right or something?
Let me make sure I'm answering your question, Mr. Comptroller. You're talking about the manufacturer and the two batches of tests.
Yeah, I'm talking about the South Korean tests, and I'm particularly interested in the ones that were used here at the State House complex for state employees.
Those are the new tests. Those are all working fine and have consistently worked fine over the last 4 or 5 months as we've been using them.
So
the first batch – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So on the first batch, the way this unfolded is we were validating the tests with three different labs. We had UMB, we had Scion, and one other. They were able to use the test, but the problem is they were slow, and it was for lack of a better, a non-technical term, they were clunky. We then asked the state public health lab to look at this first batch and tell us what the issue was, and they realized that the formula that we had gotten was an early formula and was not consistent with what the FDA had on its website. On the May 13th and 14th, we got them on the phone based on the records that I've been able to find and talking with our lab director. And they talked to the folks in Korea and said, hey, this test is having some difficulty and it's not exactly the formula. They said, you're right. We've got the formula updated. We can get you the new test. So
what month was that, Mr.
The original batch of Korean tests.
But what here, month are you referring to as far as?
Sure.
What time? When?
Well, this was May, early May. This was in early May.
So all 500,000 tests minus the 3,500 that had already been used, they were all shipped back to South Korea, is that?
They were picked up by the manufacturer, and they took control of them. Where they actually sent them, we don't know, because once they were gone, they were being stored at the Maryland State Police Laboratory, and once they were gone, they were gone. And we have the shipper document. But we just so you know, Mr. Comptroller, we've gotten a lot of questions in an audit from DLS, and we've answered a lot of these questions in detail. So that's what we've given them all of our records. So there's been a full disclosure on this whole process.
Yeah, no, I have no complaints with you, Dennis.
Yes, sir. No, I understand.
I understand because a false positive, I can assure, obviously, you are aware of this. It's incredibly disruptive. And one of my staff had a false positive, I believe, from across, you know, where the state tests were given. And, yeah, it was very disruptive because everybody has to, you know, make protocol adjustments. That's just one person. But
right.
It turns out it was a false positive.
Right.
She didn't
get
two or three subsequent PCR tests, and there's nothing there. And so I'm just suggesting that I hope what you're saying is right, that we're keeping track of false positives.
Yep.
We got kind of a back-of-the-hand ho-hum when we asked about how many. They said not very many at all or something to that effect. And I'm curious as to whether you have seen anything. I take it the new batch was used largely here at the State House testing site.
Recently they have, but we've used a lot of it for community testing, state agencies, and others. If I might add one other thing, sir, we have been working on implementing the point-of-care testing, the antigen tests that the federal government sent to us, and those have are very good. That you get very few false negatives, but as you said, those tests, and we've been comparing them to the PCR tests to get a feel for how we might use them, because we've got quite a number of them from the federal government. And we have data on about, I believe, 6,000 samples now, does show a rate of false positives, which is why we're still doing the confirmatory PCR. But the false negatives are good. And what the goal is to weed out the people who are positive, but there is it does create some situations. I would not deny what you said. But those are different tests than the PCR tests.
Yeah, I understand that. And then finally, on a related but separate subject, are you familiar with any estimated costs for the vaccine and storage, distribution, et cetera, for, I think the Lieutenant Governor mentioned the preparation for this, but is there any cost estimate?
We're still developing those, Mr. Comptroller. We're not done with that, but we've got a whole team of people pulling that together, and I know that we're anxious, the governor's anxious to get that information out, and so we're driving really hard, and soon we should have that kind of information available for you.
Well, just keep your mind later on in the year when everyone else has been vaccinated. I'm willing to have one of all five vaccines. You can give me five in a row, and I'll be happy. So, but obviously, after everybody who is important gets treated, because, well, thank you for those responses, and we may have some follow-up things after the staff.
Absolutely, sir. Thank you very much.
Yeah, all the best.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Any additional questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Not for them.
Okay. Do we have a motion to approve the remainder?
Move approval.
It's voted separately, so the remainder of the agenda.
Second.
We're all in favor. Okay. All right, Department of Natural Resources.
Hi, it's me again. Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Jeannie Hadaway Riccio, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We have 11 items on our real property agenda today. Item 5A has been revised, and I'm happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Appropriate, I move approval. I don't wonder why.
Right. Well, thank you. And I just want to say, and I want to thank the good secretary. I'm taking some personal time this weekend and spending a weekend in one of our fabulous national parks. It's a little getaway. And you know, the fact that I've been able to visit on my own time and my own expense, I'm going to be in one of the fabulous parks actually enjoying the snow. So I'll get to that. I think we have a motion, so we have votes on this. Okay, I think we're all...
No, I'm looking now. I can't talk.
No, I know who that was.
Been there, done that.
That was not me.
Okay.
Thank you all very much.
Okay, thank you. We've approved 3-0. Thank you. Okay, University System of Maryland.
Sorry about that. That was me. Tom Hickey, representing University System of Maryland. We are presenting 4 items for your consideration, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Hickey?
I had a question about item 3S. Mr. Hickey, this is a $100 million, if all the options are exercised, contract award. And I guess I have... just want to review the RFP process, if you could help me understand how we in the state are going to be convinced that we're getting the best deal possible. I'm told that after vendor selection for implementation through the RFP process, negotiations occurred and resulted in additional services related to workday. So that just caught my eye as something that seemed unusual.
There were negotiations that took place after the notice of intent to award to increase the services available. I'm not sure if Carlo Colella, who's the Vice President for Administration and Finance for the University of Maryland College Park, is still on the call. I also have Jeff Hollingsworth, who's the Chief Information Officer for University of Maryland, as well as Tim Watson, who's the Assistant Vice President for Procurement and Strategic Sourcing, all available to discuss this. So I don't know if they're available now.
Maybe we lost them in the break.
Tom, I'm available.
Tim Watson.
Good afternoon, Treasurer Cott, Lieutenant Governor Rockford, and Comptroller Franchot. In response to your question, we did go through a competitive solicitation process, and we did make a determination to issue the notice of intent to award and proceed in negotiations with the selected consulting firm based upon that competitive solicitation. As discussions ensued, we determined that we needed some additional support services with regard to the student information system portion of the RFP. Those services had been proposed in an unsolicited manner by another competitor. And I think through that process, it was determined that yes, those services would be helpful for us. So they were negotiated in. Huron was the lowest priced and the top supplier from a solicitation standpoint. They were the top in terms of meeting all of our requirements and providing what we were looking for. So they were ranked the highest, and they were also ranked the highest on pricing. Provided as the best price.
What was the initial contract for where they were given notice of award, and compared to what the final amount is $100 million? What was the original amount?
The original amount, and I have to go back to it here. Excuse me a moment. The original amount of the contract that they had offered was $32,856,156. That was their original proposal without the additional scope of work.
I'm sorry, give me that rough ballpark figure. How much was originally intended to, in the initial notice of award? How much was that contract?
The original RFP price, or the original proposed price, was $32 million.
So you went from $32 million to $100
million?
How can that be?
No,
excuse me. There are two contracts here. This is Jeff Hollingsworth.
Yes.
Mr. Comptroller, this is a single item composing a workday contract and an implementation services contract. The aggregate value of the two contracts, if all options are exercised, is $100 million. The implementation component was originally 32, and I believe the amount coming forward is 44. I'm trying to find the exact amount.
32.
Right now. 42.
The amount coming forward is 42.
What is important is because the other partner, the number two item, Accenture, bid the full scope, we did have an apples-to-apples comparison after the revision from the preferred offer of the price, and the price was substantially better with the Huron than the Accenture bid.
Okay.
The same example of work.
Accenture, if they wanted to revise their bid based on the fact that it was now for different services?
No, they had actually bid the same service. They originally, in their response, bid the scope of work that we're now putting forward for Huron.
Huron, yeah, I think that's somewhat unfair that Accenture did that, and then you added in after the fact with, it's not an insignificant amount of money, $10 or $12 million. It seems kind of odd, but...
what Huron did was they acknowledged in their response the need for this additional work and wanted to price it as an option or as a negotiated in the future. We didn't want to sign the base contract with this future liability unknown hanging over our heads. And so that's why we asked them to price it all now, which then made their pricing of the same scope of work to match what Accenture had priced.
Have you done that on any other regular basis? It seems like an odd way to come up with a final contract.
I will defer to our procurement expert on that one.
I would say this is not a routine methodology that we would use. So this is an anomaly.
And
I can't think of us doing this in other circumstances.
Yeah, I know. I can't think of seeing one of these. So I guess my question is, why exactly did you do it here, and what assurance do we have that, you know, all of the vendors were treated evenly?
Sorry, Jeff.
I want to say there's two things. First of all, remember that each of these proposals is evaluated both on a technical and a fiscal criteria. The technical evaluation for all three included the full scope of work that you're now seeing before you, and the rankings were done on that before the fiscal amounts were opened. So the technical rankings were on the full scope of work by all three proposers that you're seeing before you. It's that when we opened the pricing data, we discovered that Huron had excluded pricing this particular scope of work they described and what they were going to do, and they said they wished to price it in the future. And what we did was we allowed them to price that so that we then had a fair comparison of the full scope of work between the two highest ranked offerors.
Yeah, well, I don't have the private sector experience of Lieutenant Governor, but that seems kind of unfair to me. In other words, we're going to give you the business, but, you know, you need to fill in the blank on this part here. So what would you like us to pay you?
No, they're still bidding $12 million less than...
Yes.
Than Accenture.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
That's correct.
Yeah, why didn't you give the opportunity to Accenture?
Accenture had
already.
Yeah, but then you tell the other side, basically, I assume, what the rough amount is. I mean, it just seems odd. And, you know, I'm not quite sure what to do with it because it just strikes me as just irregular, you know, I guess would be put it the right way, because we're accustomed to seeing apples to apples, and what you're bringing us is apples to oranges.
Well, excuse me, Comptroller Grinchot. I think this is a situation where we had proposers who proposed on really essentially the same thing. We had one proposer who didn't provide the pricing in their proposal. We went back to them. And we did it during negotiation to request that pricing, so we could do that fair comparison.
Okay, I understand, but you told them after you told them you were going to pick them.
Well, at that point, we had issued the notice of intent to award, correct?
Yeah, that's a problem. Not that I'm expert for procurement. Boyd, you are far more expert than I, but I think that raises a few eyebrows, but
yeah, that's a little different. The question I would have: did Huron know what Accenture did? That would then be, I think, a big issue.
No,
absolutely not.
Okay.
I don't think, you know, that would be the biggest concern, is that if they knew, you know, what the bid was, and they can, you know, make sure that they're below that number.
I think a similar question. There is still, after all is said and done, the $12 million. Can they really do it for that sum?
We have extreme confidence in the firm. They were technically ranked highest in part because of their experience in higher education.
But Accenture has experience in higher ed, doesn't it?
The particular team they put forward did not have the same depth of experience because we asked not only for the firm but the specific principals that would be working on the work.
Well, I'm sure the Board of Regents is going to be holding you to that amount. They come back and need another $10 million. That's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
Particularly since the university system, you know, has some challenges, you know, financially, given the, you know, the coronavirus and enrollment and the challenges that they've had. Okay, I have a question though, because there is some concern expressed about integration with FEMIS. I don't want to, you know, spend a lot of time with that. And there was some discussion that there may be a procurement module that the system may explore when we have, you know, email and marketing advantage that is being implemented. Is there any concern, or they may be two different issues?
The contracts that are before you today do not include any procurement module whatsoever. We had a nice discussion with Bob Gleason and Mike Hafley last night to discuss this project. We've been part of the EMMA Executive Steering Committee. We helped draft the RFP for project that's underway now. So we're at the table. In fact, there was a meeting at 1 o'clock that I was supposed to be at for executive committee. So we're very anxious, for the next phases of the EMMA project, and we are going to evaluate that, once the state integration has taken place.
Okay. And any concerns about FEMIS and the integration there?
It's my understanding that these particular contracts will not integrate with FEMIS.
Okay. All right.
This is their enterprise resource system. So this is their individual financial student information services and human resources.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Well, Governor, can I ask that this item be voted on separately? I don't really feel comfortable with the. I'm not suggesting there's anything untoward with the folks involved. I'm just suggesting I don't like the uniqueness of this project, a process. And so I'm going to register no vote. I'm assuming both of you will vote yes, but let me know if you're not, because I'm not kidding. No, I'm kidding.
You changed your mind. Okay. Yes, that's fine. Are there any other questions on the university agenda?
I do have a question on that one, just to follow up. We did get an inquiry from DLS. Can I assume that you're speaking with the people at DGS? OSP responded also to the DLS concerns. I think they were the same concern.
I spoke directly with DLS and with Bob Gleason and Mike Hafley. So we're in contact with both
Great.
Organizations.
I would second the motion.
Okay.
So I just confirm that item 3 was a 2-1 vote to approve the item.
Correct. I'm voting in favor of item 3. We're just talking about that. Madam Treasurer, you're on
yes,
item 3.
Okay.
Now, do we have a motion for the rest of the university system agenda?
That's appropriate.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And again, I apologize for my outburst earlier.
Mr. Hickey, just harking back for a second to this morning and early afternoon, I'm impressed to see the additional information of sustainability regarding item four, and look forward to seeing that sort of information throughout your
government.
Okay. All right. So I think we have approval for the university system, correct? Okay. All in favor on the remainder with the exception of item three. Okay. Department of Transportation.
Good afternoon. Hope everyone is doing well. Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Rick Slater, Secretary of Maryland Department of Transportation. The Maryland Department of Transportation has 10 items for your consideration today, and myself and representatives are certainly here to answer any questions that you may have.
I'm not going to belabor it. I just don't like seeing several retroactive items from, in this case, Maryland Aviation. I know they're revenue contracts, but there needs to be a little bit more diligence in this matter.
Yes, sir.
If I could just second that, Lieutenant Governor. The explanation in the briefing document was they were not brought to us because they were, in quote, inadvertently not brought to the board for approval. So that just, you know, kind
of... Well, it's better than if it were intentional.
What?
It's better than if it were intentional.
Yeah, okay, but I would hate to see that rationale repeated after this because... It obviously catches your eye as to what's going on. So I'm glad Mr. Slater is there and in charge, and I have complete confidence in him. But I do have a question, Lieutenant Governor, about item 6M.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's related to this inadvertence of inadvertently not bringing contracts before us.
Yes, sir. I have Executive Director Ricky Smith on the line to answer any questions you may have as well.
Great. So this is an item that the airport is asking for approval of a sole source maintenance contract for 6 interactive Mobo robots that we've heard much about recently, the R2-D2s or whatever they are up there. The contract provides for the maintenance, service, repair, adjusting, and testing of interactive customer service robots at BWI Third Dudley Marshall Airport. The request also brings the assignment of the robots and personal property from SP Plus to MDOT-MAA for approval. So it's my understanding the acquisition of these customer service robots were subject of a Office of Legislative Audit that found some irregularities and potential violations. Procurement process, if I'm understanding it correctly, the MAA authorized, reimbursed the vendor for acquiring 6 customer service robots that to this day have not been utilized. So first, if I could just ask Mr. Smith for what was the original intended use of the robots? Or Mr. Slater?
This is Ricky Smith, Executive Director of the Maryland Aviation Administration. Good afternoon, Madam Controller, Governor, and Madam Treasurer. I'm sorry, Mr. Controller. It's been a long day. Sorry about that. So the original purpose of the robots was to, and still is to provide wayfinding and parking support services to our customers. So. As you can imagine, customer service is a real big deal for the airport, and we are in a very competitive environment, as with some other airports. But our situation is somewhat unique in that we have 2 other airports to the south of us. And so airports across the country and the world are looking for innovative and cost-effective approaches to delivering customer service. So it was recommended to us by our parking management service to consider robots as a means to, one, providing information on parking and other ground transportation services, as well as wayfinding information and information on destinations outside of the airport. And so the robots have been programmed to provide wayfinding information, information on destinations outside of the airport, in multiple languages. In order to bring online the parking payment feature, for example, we first have to have the maintenance contract in place, because that requires some additional work for them. And so the original purpose was to bring them on, to provide additional extended support of our customer service efforts, and to be able to do that in a manner that was consistent with what the industry seems to be doing in terms of using automation and technology to engage with our customers.
Okay, so this contract's for 1,431,600 for customer service. Have these robots been used since their acquisition in November 2018?
So back in last year, the spring of last year, we actually had the robot out on the floor doing a pilot, engaging with passengers to get a feel for how the passengers would receive them and how they would interact. Since then, we've been programming the robots. Once the legislative audit came out, we stalled all actions on the robots, because the expectation was that we would get Board of Public Works approval before we did anything else with the robots. And so back in June, we came to the board, and we thanked the board for approving a transaction to repay the to assign the robots to us. And what we're now trying to do is to get the Board of Public Works to approve the maintenance contract that will allow the repairs and enhancements to the robots so we can then begin using them. Our plan is to have them on the floor late January, early February.
And I take it they're going to be able to process parking payments?
Yes, sir. The plan is to have them process parking payments and to have that done in compliance with standards that are in place for protecting such transactions.
So the reason I bring it up in part is because these are Russian robotics from a Russian robotics startup company, which describes itself as the largest manufacturer of so-called service robots in Northern and Eastern Europe. I guess just to be blunt about it, Reggie, are you guys convinced these things are secure from a technical thing, given the fact that Russia is not exactly a friend of the United States?
Yeah, the answer is yes. So they are Russian manufactured robots. The Russians manufacture basically the shell. The operating system is a Linux operating system, which is a world-renowned U.S. company that controls the operating system. Today, until we install the parking payment system, the robots are only providing information. They're not collecting any information other than the number of times somebody might ask a particular question, because that gives us feedback on what the customer's concerns and interests are. Once the parking system is in place, which will include the credit card system, they will then begin collecting information through the credit cards. And as I said earlier, the credit card system will be installed with the industry's credit card standards in place, security standards in place.
Okay. Are there any additional costs involved with that that you're going to bring before the board?
There are no additional costs associated with this. The 843,000 item is not to exceed, and so it is no guarantee that we will spend that entire amount. But based on what we know we need to do with the robots today to get them on the floor to provide the services that we want, we bake that into this maintenance agreement.
And is it true that former Governor Schwarzenegger out in California is suing the company because one of the robots apparently out in an airport there was dressed up to look just like Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Well, they are muscular figures. but I'm not aware of Arnold Schwarzenegger suing.
When we get good and bored down here, if you could bring one down and show it to us, I'd be delighted.
Absolutely.
Keep us in the loop as to the security, because that does I mean, half the time I think this Echo thing or Alexis that's in my kitchen is listening to me rather than me.
It is.
Play some music or something.
We will certainly arrange for a demonstration or a tour at your will.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you.
Just to make sure, Ricky, I think I understood your question. Whatever would be collecting information, oral or from a credit card, that information stays with the system that is not connected in any way to the Russian company?
So my IT team tells me that it is a local data-based system, that it is not a system that is transferred outside of the locale. It is a locally-based system.
And
again, I'm sorry, go ahead, Madam President.
I just want to make sure that this did not result in actual live people losing jobs, did it, or will it?
No, but I will say this. I mean we have a real need to expand our presence in parts of the terminal to provide this kind of wayfinding support to customers, and we do have one ambassador contract that provides that kind of support with our security checkpoints and our customs and border protection. It is a very, very expensive contract to provide the kind of services that the robots will be providing. And so we don't think it's in the best fiscal interest of the state to expand that contract to provide the service. And we don't think that we would be able to bring on additional state employees to provide that service anytime soon, and that would be even more expensive. So we think from an economic standpoint, it's the best approach to go. We also think that there's an entertainment element to it as well. When we had the robots out on the floor about a year or so ago, that passengers were, and they really enjoyed interacting with the robots.
Let me just say, I get that. I love little robots, but I'm not for getting rid of live people. Using Russian robots instead.
So what I will say is, no, we are not we're not laying off or furloughing anybody for this for the purpose of these robots. We do not currently have employees on our staff or our payroll that provide this service. The service is provided by some volunteers and the contract that I just mentioned to you.
Madam Treasurer, I'd like to add, too, that we have a wonderful volunteer program over at the airport, and a number of our senior citizens and retired folks come out of there and help, and they're a great asset to us. And in fact, that was one of the immediate challenges that we had to deal with in the pandemic was we were very concerned that some of our older citizens were out and about in the airport, and we wanted to make sure that there was some protection in place there.
You'll keep an eye on that. Ricky, I appreciate what you said. You seem to be wording it very carefully, though, which makes me a little nervous.
I'm sorry. I certainly don't want to create any skepticism.
No, I'm just a skeptical person. But could I ask also, Mr. Secretary, apropos of number five, I don't want to go back to number five, but if you can keep us informed as develop with the concessionaires and how in the face of the economic impact on them of coronavirus, et cetera, how we're dealing with them there.
Absolutely. I can actually set up some time specifically to talk about those if it's helpful. You know, this number five was some rent relief that was instituted pretty quickly, but we're working something separately, trying to find the best package for our concessionaires. And many of those are small businesses that have been in the airport for quite some time, and we want to make sure that they're there when that traveling public returns.
Yeah, I do want to add one clarification because we there's a tendency to use concessionaires loosely. This item does not involve any of our food and retail operations. That's just one type of concessionaire. All revenue-generating contracts and those service providers at the airport are considered concessionaires.
Okay. I would say, well,
Treasurer, thank you for bringing that up.
We absolutely value your input. I anticipate us coming back to the board at some point with some modifications associated with the concessionaire, so we'd love some input on that as that's being developed.
Okay.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any additional questions on transportation agenda?
Move approval.
Okay. All in favor? I think we have 3-0 vote on that. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you.
Department of General Services. I know we've been waiting a long time.
Good afternoon. Governor and Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Vincent Churchill, Secretary for the Maryland Department of General Services. Today on our agenda, we have 33 items for your consideration. We are withdrawing items 9 and 14, and we are available to answer any questions you may have this time.
This has been a long day. I do want to just commend the capital grant and loans that are going, that are particularly addressing areas of mental health. That is something that's very important to me. Cornerstone Montgomery does an excellent job in that area. I'm glad to see that they are getting the state assistance. Also, Shepherd Pratt, which is putting in building a new facility in Howard County along Route 95, it's kind of well needed additional space beds for those who are suffering from mental illness, severe mental illness. So I just wanted to point that out. I have to mention the parks, the Friends of Jerusalem Mill, that they're getting services to help them. And so I just wanted to point those items out in particular. And then, of course, there's a construction project at Smallwood State Park, which I've had the opportunity to visit there as well in Charles County. There's some others that I'll talk about, but I'll ask if there are any additional questions. Doesn't sound like anyone has any questions.
No, I just want to say year in and year out, I always have a question for something on DGS.
Breaking your record here, there's a new precedent.
I do have what I think is a really brief question, but item 25, the fund managers for small minority-owned businesses.
Right.
Just what's happening with that? Madam Secretary.
Hello. How are you, Madam Treasurer? Thank you for asking that question. So this is our annual review. For the record, I'm Kelly Schultz, Secretary of the Department of Commerce. And I have my team on as well, but this is an annual designation, or it has been in the past an annual designation, but the funding for these fund managers has been diverted over the course of the last 4 fiscal years to the education fund. So this year we're actually able to put some of those VLP funds, as we've known them in the past, as part of the original gaming them that had passed that it would go to economic development and businesses within each of those regions. So we do have 8 fund managers in those regions that their goal is to get funding out to their localities within the general surroundings of the casinos, but also to expand. There's a certain percentage, and so that was all based on statutory requirements. So this year is the first year since 2016 that we're able to statutorily put funding into the appropriations and refund those accounts.
Good. Well, I'm sure they'll use it well.
They always have. They always have. We're very proud of our fund managers, that's for sure.
Thank you.
And it's needed. Thank you, Madam Secretary. Mr. Secretary, real brief, I see that the surplus item for the Schaefer House buildings that had previously been used by juvenile services, and I think even before that, public safety used those facilities. We had talked about possibly using those buildings there for transitional housing for those who are suffering from substance use disorder that are coming out of the treatment facilities, but they need a place to go rather than just going back to their old communities and possibly the stimuli associated with that. In response to the state senator there, one of the local delegates, and the councilman, we decided to just surplus it to see if there's a market opportunity for it. They're hoping that they can get a boutique hotel or something of that nature there. We'll see what the market has, but I do stress again, as I mentioned to them, and they are aware of this, that we do need the transitional housing. It's not, you know, a halfway house. It's not a rehab center. It's not, you know, it has been used for corrections, and it has been used as a residential facility in the past, but we do need, you know, those types of facilities for people who are coming out of, you know, the treatment facilities. And I've spoken to many people at treatment facilities, and they say the biggest issue is where do they go from there? Because they feel going back into their old environments right away is a difficult situation, and it means it makes it a little easier to regress. So we'll be watching to see what comes of this in terms of, you know, surplusing this particular property. They're beautiful buildings, I just have to say. I guess they were built back in the 30s.
They are beautiful buildings, and it is in an area that is being revitalized. It's a beautiful site, and I think that they should garner a fair amount of attention. Of course, the state is looking to receive fair market value, and so when we bring that back to the board with any recommendations concerning an offer, you know, we'll look forward to seeing the potential of that site. So, yeah.
Okay.
And Mr. Secretary, I hope that overall there will not be a net decrease in the name Schaefer.
Yes. Very good. Yeah.
Point taken.
The Schaefer Tower, we have the International Terminal at BWI, at least, and I'm quite sure there are more Schaefer things around. So hopefully the future generations will know of the great governor and mayor and comptroller, William Donald Schaefer.
Maybe we'll sneak in a Nancy Kopp statue somewhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Part of the Treasury building, right?
I was going to say, this is where we started off. You want to make sure future generations remain cultures.
Yeah. We got to remind people, you know. I mean, I make a point of using old terms around my kids and staff so that they understand. I thought for a moment that the comptroller was wearing what modern-day people call jeans. My dad used to always call them dungarees. So I use that term from time to time, and people look at me, what?
That's what I'm wearing that you can't see.
All right. Well, are there any more questions on the DGS, Department of General Services agenda?
Move approval.
Second.
All right. Thank you for this marathon session at the Board of Public Works.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay. And the stand-up doesn't quite work.
well-intentioned but failed experiment.
Well,
try another way.
I have experiments. Okay. All right. Thank you. Take care. I guess I thought I...